For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Lord, just thanks for this time to be together, and we just recognize, Lord, that you've said that when we gather together in your name, that you're present in our midst, and so we believe that that's true, that you are here with us, that you have a desire to communicate in a personal way to each one of us here tonight through your word, and so we just ask for that ability to set aside these things that are occupying our minds so that we could focus in on you, and we ask, Lord, just that the things that we are getting some conviction about, some understanding of, that we'd be able to communicate that to our brothers and sisters here tonight so that we could grow together in you. Amen. Okay, and so here we are. I'm going to just jump right into the thing to give you a feeling of what's going on here. We've been asking three questions in our study of John because these are the three things that the John's Gospel surrounds. It's the question of who is Jesus? And we've been talking a lot, especially in chapters 8 through 10, about who is Jesus, because that's what John is really focusing in on towards this latter part of Jesus' ministry. Just a whole lot of teaching about who is Christ and what has he come to do. And secondly, what is the life that he has come to offer those who seek him. And so those things have been working there in play, but tonight we're going to especially focus on what does belief in Christ look like for you now. That's what this passage is really all about. And it begins in chapter 12, verse 1, where it says, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom he raised from the dead. And so they made Jesus a supper there, and Martha was serving. Lazarus was one of those reclining at table with him. And so this is kind of the setting. This is the situation. It says 6 days before Passover, Jesus is crucified on the Passover. So this would be Saturday. He dies on Friday. So it's the beginning of the last week of Christ's earthly ministry. He's hanging out in Bethany. These are among friends. This is where, as we read last week, he had raised Lazarus from the dead, that there was this great stir that was created, kind of the pinnacle of Jesus' ministry in the sense that it's like we've seen miraculous things from Jesus, blind people sighted, deaf people hearing, lepers cleaned, all these things, but now a man who's dead in the ground for 4 days, risen from the dead, and it just creates this incredible rift between people, and they have polarized for and against Jesus. So it's in that framework and context that Jesus is having dinner at Lazarus's house. The familiar faces of Mary and Martha are there. And it says in verse 3 that Mary took a pound of very costly perfume of pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house is filled with the fragrance of perfume. So here is this scene. They're sitting around having a nice dinner together. And in the ancient Near Eastern world, having dinner together, it's a super social time. They're sitting around on pillows, you know, and they're leaning back. And they're having good conversation. And they're getting their hands in the grub. And they're eating and yucking it up. And then all of a sudden, in breaks Mary with this vial, good-sized vial of perfume that she breaks open and then begins to wash Jesus' feet like a common slave, but not with water and a towel, but with this perfume and her own hair. And it's just an amazing sight, and just the smell of it, quite remarkable. It just fills the entire room with the smell of this perfume. Very interesting. It's wild. And what this is it's really an act of faith. It's an act of devotion that Mary gives to Jesus out of this deep gratitude, I think, for raising her brother from the dead and all that has gone with that, just this recognition, this kind of caught up in the moment of who Jesus is. And so for this reason, this is kind of like a paradigm. It's a picture of what does it look like to really respond to Jesus in faith. And again, we're plugging into this theme that John has been driving about what is the nature of faith, what does it look like to believe in him. I want to just kind of break this down a little bit by talking about what is belief. And we could go to the Bible and get some different descriptions of what that looks like. I went to Webster's to get a definition. And here's what Webster says. He says, a state or habit of mind in which trust or confidence is placed in some person or thing. Belief is a conviction of the truth of some statement or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on examination or evidence. I read that this week and I thought, man, that's a great definition. That should be in the dictionary. Oh, it is in the dictionary. It's really kind of a biblical definition for belief too, and in some ways cuts cross purposes with our own culture's way of viewing belief. There's two dimensions of this that I want to bring to your attention and then show how Mary really is responding in this kind of faith when she does what she does for Jesus. First, it says that belief is a state or habit of mind. It's a conviction of the truth. It's based on examination and evidence. And so what it means is that belief means being convinced and having good reason for the commitment that faith or belief involves. Boy, you know how interesting that is. Just because I think if this definition of belief were to be given today, it would be somewhat different. It would be, belief is accepting as true whatever you want to be true. Belief means if you are passionate about it enough, then it's true for you. And because that's kind of where our culture has gone with this thing, that the real important thing is just that you believe, that you have some convictions about something. It doesn't matter what it is or why. It's important that you believe. But, you know, that is so different. And the reason why I'm working out of the dictionary is because this was written long enough ago that it shows the real slide in our culture from how belief has always been understood, really down to this generation, really. Which is that it's not just a choice, a grasping at straws in the dark, but it's always been understood as something, a belief that has its integrity because it's something that is rooted in a satisfied mind, something that we've thought about. That beliefs are not just like our choice of ice cream, you know, I like vanilla, well that's cool, I like chocolate, oh that's nice for you. But belief is something that's rooted in deep convictions, having explored the nature of the question. I like that. And then secondly, there is this other element that says that belief is a trust or confidence placed in some person or thing. And so now it goes from the intellectual, the idea of being convinced about something, to the action, a trust or confidence, which is an action that's consistent with the conviction that our minds have brought us to. So both of those things are in play when we talk about faith. Faith is having come to some conclusions, having investigated the matter based upon the examination of evidence, and then it's the choice then to say, because I have come to the conclusion that this is so, that this belief then has a certain authority in my life, that for the sake of integrity, I must act in a way that's consistent with it. And again, I think that this definition is just, it's a very biblical idea of what faith really is. The author of Hebrews in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1 says that faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. And in that sense, is really saying the same thing that we're describing here. The assurance of things hoped for. Assurance comes through having experienced God, having investigated these things about God, and having come to a place of a satisfied mind. Assurance. And then the conviction of things not seen. Conviction, again, deals with this whole, it's not merely intellectual, but it has to do with my will, the choices that I make, my willingness to pursue those things that I've become convinced about. Mary, I think in a profound way, kind of describes what this is about. And the other people in the room that night sitting around the table offer us, I think, poignant contrast to the faith that Mary exhibits. Let's think about Mary just for a moment, and then we'll come back to her towards the end. Is she convinced? Certainly Mary is convinced that Jesus is the Messiah, that Jesus is the Lord, that Jesus has the power even over death itself, the unique power that only God has. Because she's seen it. She saw her brother in the last chapter raised from the dead. So she would have to basically deny what she had seen with her own eyes, not to be convinced that he is who he says he is, that he is God's Messiah. What about the action that she takes? Certainly that she is the mark of consistency in this area. If Jesus is in fact God incarnate, if he is the long-awaited Messiah, if he does have these powers over even death itself, then what would it be like to respond to God if you saw him face to face? And Mary takes this pound, the very costly perfume, and breaks it open and just lavishes it on Christ, and in doing this really throws her entire future and all of her security on Christ. Here's a bit of context. In the ancient world, there was no safety net socially. There was no social security, no Medicare, nothing like that. And so families would hand down things of great value from parents to children, just in the event that they became widowed or whatever, and they had no way to support themselves. And so in this particular case, and among poor people especially, people who did not really have property to give to their children, they would give them what little things they could. In this case, Mary has this vial of costly perfume, of nard, it's called. And later we know that the value of it is 300 denarii, which is almost a whole year's income. So, you know, if the average income of somebody in this room is somewhere in the $50,000 range, that's a $50,000 bag of perfume. And so it's worth incredible value, and especially incredible value to her, because it represents, in some ways, it may even represent her marryability. A suitor would ask, what are you bringing to the table? And no, you don't have a cow and you don't have land. How about some of that perfume? You know, because we may need something like that down the road. Well, sorry, I lavished that on Jesus a while ago. It's gone. All you got's me. What do you think? And sadly, in the ancient world, that's just not enough. Because they're looking for marriages as kind of mergers that really have an economic component as well. She just takes everything that she has of value and lavishes it in a moment on Christ. That's what she does. Now, here's the interesting thing. There's a response. It says in verse 4 that Judas Iscariot, and John just kind of tells us parenthetically, he's the one who is one of his disciples who is intending to betray him, said to Mary, why has this perfume not been sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? And then John inserts, now he said this not because he was concerned about the poor, but because he was a thief, and as he had the money box, he used to pilfer what was put in it. So here's a very different reaction. And he is incredulous with Mary. He can't believe it. Judas, the one who we're told never called Jesus Lord. It's very interesting because Judas has seen the same things as everybody else. He witnessed the resurrection of Lazarus just like Mary and the rest of the disciples did. He had been touring around with Jesus for 3 years. He had seen people healed. He had seen the profound clarity of Jesus's teaching. He had seen the way that in a gracious manner he interacts with hurting people, with guilty people struggling with their guilt and offering them forgiveness. And he had seen the whole range of what Jesus was about right up front, a front row seat. And yet, unconvinced, apparently. Not like Mary was convinced. He saw the same things. He drew a very different conclusion. He had seen Lazarus raised from the dead. But Jesus does not match Judas's expectations. We don't know a lot about who Judas really was. And it has often been argued that Judas was probably a member of a sect called Zealots. These are people who were committed to the military, the violent overthrow of the Roman government. And that the surmising is, and I think it's rooted in a fair reading of kind of the whole picture of Judas's life, that he came to a point where early on he was amazed at what Jesus was saying and doing. It was clear that he was just from God. And a huge crowd was beginning to follow, and he was seeing in this the fulfillment of his own aspirations, his own hopes that somehow through this man, Rome would be defeated and God's nation would be reestablished on its own, just like it had in centuries past. And when it began to be clear to Judas that that was not Jesus' agenda, and that he was not a political leader, and that he didn't even register to vote, that Judas came to the conclusion, that's not what I'm looking for, and just basically began to decide that he's going to have to set his sights in a different direction. But it really, I think, illustrates an unfortunate and indeed profound point. Namely, that the mind tends to follow the heart. Judas had decided the Messiah he wanted, and Jesus, as it turns out, did not fit that expectation. And so, in consequence, he was able to just more or less ignore or suppress the things that he did know to be true about Christ, the things that he had witnessed even with his own eyes. And I take this as a profound cautionary tale. And it tells us the extent to which we can find ourselves self-deceived. If we set our hearts against who God has said that he is and what he intends to do, it is possible just to completely lose all objectivity. I have a couple people in my life, people that I've known for many years and know fairly well, who've taken very different trajectories in their life. And the one is a young man who grew up with a fairly robust faith. And for a period of time wrestled, but with some integrity with that faith, and came to a place, a conflict, where God, he sensed, was moving him in a particular direction to deal with some of the internal things in his own life, in his character. And he was not prepared to go that way. And so he makes this kind of separation with God. And he's like, I no longer want to follow. And it was very interesting to observe over a period of just as few as weeks and months that all of the insight that was developed over many years in this man's life had been completely lost. His capacity, even when you sit down and say, well, okay, you're taking this atheistic bent these days, how do you explain these things that you know from the Old Testament, these incredible predictions about the coming of God's Messiah? And his answer was, I don't know. I'm like, you don't know? That's not good enough. That's not an honest response. You used to have a view on this based upon your investigation of these matters, the history of it, the interpretation of it. Now you just shrug your shoulders and you say, ooh. See, there's a lack of sincerity in that. And I suspect that that is the same sort of trajectory that a man like Judas was on. Initially responding with great hopes for what could be, and then beginning to realize that his expectations were not fulfilled in Jesus. And so, as Jesus himself says in Matthew chapter 13, citing the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 6, he says, they keep on seeing, but they don't see. And they keep hearing, but they don't hear. Because why? He says, because their hearts have been closed to God. And so I think that this is just something that we need to be mindful of, that it is, that to protect our hearts from self-deceit, that there's a humility that comes that enables us to experience the true belief that someone like Mary has right here. A humility to be taught, to be able to set my expectations aside so that I can actually hear from the living God, not to determine from that God what's actually true. And so in my experience, I have found that when I'm beginning to have a lot of confusion and I'm not seeing clearly, I need to ask myself, what's going on in my heart that has robbed me of the clarity that I once had about these matters, about what it means to live for Christ? And I think the older we get sometimes, the more we pick up habits of the heart that kind of move us in a direction that's just maybe imperceptible at first, but increasingly over time the gap widens and we begin to realize, I'm moving in the direction of my life and God is calling me over here, and there's a chasm in between and I don't hear from Him like I once did. It's the lack of clarity is there, and it's at that point that we need to stop and say, Lord, where have I gone? Why can I not hear your voice? What is it in me that thwarts my ability to hear you calling to me? And so just if, you know, if that's some place where you're at, if you understand that, identify with that. That's something to really consider here, that a big part of having integrity in our faith is to guard our hearts, to watch our hearts. Am I prepared to respond to the voice of God? And then, of course, because Judas was not convinced, or if he was, he had lost his confidence by this time, he acts. And here I think we'd have to say that Judas's actions are actually very consistent with the conclusions that he came to. That he had done a cost-benefit calculation and decided that Jesus was worth, well, not 300 denarii of pure nard, but maybe 30 pieces of silver, perhaps. The cost of betrayal. That's basically what he was worth. In the mind of Judas, here's this misguided messianic figure who's not fulfilling my expectations. It's time to cut bait and run and get out of this just what little I possibly can. That's what Judas ends up doing. He makes a judgment on Mary. Why has this perfume not been sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor? What a waste this is. Mary, he says, he concludes, is a fool. A fool because she has poured everything she has at the feet of Christ. What a fool. And so you see just the collision of worlds coming together in that room that night. And, you know, it's interesting to think. Here's Mary. She's risked everything for Christ. What has Judas risked in his act of defiance, in his act of rejecting Christ? Well, you might want to think about this a little bit. There's a parable that Jesus gives earlier in Luke chapter 12 that sort of fits into this, talking about fools. Jesus says that the land of a rich man was very productive. A rich man. And he began reasoning to himself, what shall I do since I have no place to store my crops? Then he said, ah, this is what I will do. I'll tear down my old, small, shabby, embarrassing barns and build larger, shinier barns. And there I will store all my grain. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. Yeah, the life of Riley, just laying out there, the fat of my exploits finally coming in, that IRA's full, whatever it is. But the story's not over, because it says that God said to him, you fool! This very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? And so he says, so is the one who stores up treasure for himself but is not rich toward God. Is Mary a fool or is Judas a fool? Well, that all depends, doesn't it? On this very point right here. If You have whatever years you have to amass, whatever you can amass, to enjoy however long you can, and then that's the end of you. Then Mary's a fool, because she's just throwing it all away. On the other hand, if it's true that there is a God before whom we will all stand to give account for what did we do with the revelation that he gave to us about himself, a God who is holy in character in contrast to our own sinfulness. Well, then we got a different take on who is the fool here. But I think that the contrast, just as in this meal that was being had together on this week before Jesus' execution, his crucifixion, bears the point. What is it? What is the foolish path? That depends on what's true, what's real. You say to yourself, I believe that there's a God. I believe these things are true. Then you really need to think through, then, what does it mean to live consistently with that and not be a fool? You say to yourself, well, I'm just not so sure. I don't know. That's cool. That's okay. And if you are a genuine seeker after truth, if you're one who has integrity and belief, then I just encourage you to follow the evidence laid out even in this book, the Gospel of John, and go make your faith commitments where the evidence takes you. But don't be in this insincere place where you say, on the one hand, I believe that Jesus is the Messiah, I believe all these things are true of him, but I'm going to live as though I'm this rich fool who's just got all of his treasure in his silo and not at the feet of Christ. That's the contrast. That's the foolishness of the thing. Which brings us then to the other people who are gathered at that table that night, the disciples. This is Matthew's account, Matthew 26. He says, the disciples, not just Judas, but the disciples, it says, were indignant when they saw Mary do this, and they said, why this waste? Well, we could understand, of course, why Judas would say that what Mary had done was a total waste, but the disciples? Really? Why were they indignant? What was behind that? The disciples were convinced of who Jesus was, just as Mary. I mean, we've seen this already in our study of the Gospel of John in chapter 11, the very chapter right before this. Thomas, the one who is the doubter, said to his fellow disciples, let's go along with Jesus down to Jerusalem so that we may die with him. We're going to stand with him because we know that he is the Messiah, just as Peter had earlier said in chapter 6, verse 68, when Simon Peter answered Jesus and he said, Lord, to whom shall we go? We're not going to leave you. We're not going to quit following. Why? He says, because you have the words of eternal life and we have believed that you are the Holy One of God. So in that sense, what Mary believed is the same thing that the disciples believed. They were convinced in pretty much exactly the same way. And yet, what about the consistency of their actions? They, it says, are indignant. They saw what Mary did as a total waste. And so the question here is, why were the disciples embarrassed by the extravagance of Mary's devotion to Christ? That's the question on the table for us here tonight. We want to explore that and think about that just for a few minutes here. Why is it that they can start at the same place, believe the same things, and then end up with very, very different responses? One in just absolute surrender of all, and the other embarrassed by that, indignant. What defines, what makes that happen? Well, you could think, well, you know, maybe the disciples, like Judas, had a real concern for the poor. And they're like, oh no, this is a precious resource. We can give it to the poor. The poor. A deep concern for poverty and doing the right thing. And yet, that's not what's really in play here at all. Jesus says in verse 7. This is back in John 12. Therefore, Jesus says, leave her alone. She did this in preparation for my burial, for you will always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me. Jesus understood that the issue had to do with the heart, and that the disciples were not seeing something that Mary did. And they were embarrassed by that, and so they were looking for reasons to explain their embarrassment, to justify their indignation. And so it's, it's a bad allocation of resources. And Jesus' point is, look, you know, the poor are going to be around. Because poverty is not an issue of resources, it's an issue of allocation of those resources. But you will not always have me. And so he's bringing them to the heart of the issue that really they're rendering judgments in their indignation about the worthiness of Christ to be given all. And so really, in reality, Mary's action exposes something that they lack, He says, I say to you, wherever this gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, he says, what this woman has done will be spoken of in memory of her. Jesus looks at this example, this real simple act of faith. And he says, it's so profound and so spot on and so accurate that no explaining it away about the poor or anything else will do. That this is, when we talk about what does it look like to believe, I want that story to be told everywhere in memory of her. What a legacy is that? Not too bad. So let's just kind of break it down a little bit and describe that faith. What does Mary teach us in this simple act of devotion that was so scandalous to Judas and so embarrassing to the disciples? Well, just a couple things. And the first is that in Jesus' actions, she's declaring that Jesus is worthy of her spare change, of the leftover time after work, family, soap operas, and golf. That Jesus is worthy of everything. That's what she's saying. See, Mary realizes that there's room at the center for just one. And so we have to make a choice. Who occupies that center? Will you occupy that center of your life? Or will Jesus Christ? So really, it's a question of sovereignty at this point, of who actually is the Lord. And here, we just find ourselves having to ask ourselves this question, do I believe that I'm a creature created by God to live in dependence on Him and in relation to Him? That all that I have is a gift from Him, a gift that He wants to occupy the center of my life to begin to fulfill what is the purpose of those great gifts? Or do I say, I'm an individual, I hold on to my right to absolute sovereignty over my life, and I will let God cooperate with my agenda as God feels like He wants to? So I'm going to pursue the things that I'm going to pursue, and the people and the whatever with my life I'm going to do, and sure do believe that, especially when I visit God every week and have these reverent words to say to Him or whatever, you know, that He must be impressed by that. That's civil religion. That's the religion that dominates our culture. We're a nation of individuals. We celebrate the absolute sovereignty of the individual, and then we wonder, well, where's God? And what Mary is expressing here in this very simple act is that she is not at the center, that Jesus Christ is the center of her life, worthy of all, worthy of all. Have you ever presented your whole being to God? You know, it takes nothing but an act of receiving, of trusting in the adequacy of the cross of Christ to be made right with God. That's the good news of the gospel. It's free. It only requires of you that you humble yourself to the extent that you recognize and acknowledge to God that you need a gift. You need to be forgiven. That's all it is. But if we want to move on with Jesus Christ in our life, if we want that saving faith to revolutionize our life, to create a transformation from the inside out, if we want to have something real and vital in our relationship with God, a power that we have to engage also with other people in our lives, then we're asking something of a different question. It's the question a disciple asks. What does it look like for me to follow? And that's a different decision, and it requires and it involves exactly what Mary is describing right here. Not that I'm cleaning up my own act, I'm making myself better, I'm picking myself up by the bootstraps, I'm stopping doing all those things that I'm embarrassed by and starting to do all these new things over here. That's religion. It's a religious solution. It's follow the code or whatever. But no, what God is saying is, if you want me to occupy that center in your life, then present yourself to me, like Mary has done. Just present all of who you are to me. Paul puts it like this. He says, I urge you. By the mercies of God, in other words, on the basis of his grace, that his great love for you, I urge you to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service of worship. That's what it is. That's what makes sense. The disciples, what they were about didn't make sense. They believed that God was in Jesus Christ, that he was the Lord, the fulfillment of their long anticipated hopes for the Messiah. They believe all those things, but then they, when it came right down to it, it's like, yeah, but see, and we see over the next week as they're talking to Jesus, they're still jockeying for position. Hey, James and John send their mother to Jesus, and they say to her, you go ask him if he'll let one of us sit on the right hand and the other on the left in these positions of respect and authority when he establishes his kingdom. What a wimp. That's so lame. I can't believe how lame that is. They're always about who's going to serve me, who's the greatest. These debates that take place in the next chapter, chapter 13 of John, is on. Pretty amazing stuff. But see, if we want to have something real going with God, I think we want that. That's why we're here tonight. It comes to us in the simplicity of Mary's offering. I just give Jesus in a moment. I make a decision to give to him all that I have of value. I just present to him, as Paul says here, my body, my life. And it's a decision that you make at a point in time. You just say to the Lord God, thank you for what you've done for me, and in response I want to just give you myself. I don't know what that means exactly. I'm not sure where you're going to take it. But you've demonstrated that you are a God of love and mercy, of compassion, of great power, and I trust you with my life. And so I just give you my life. And I plea with you here tonight, if you're one who has never really in a conscious way come before God like that, just to say, I understand what's being called on here. I know what this is about. And for good reason, I'm convinced. And now because I'm convinced, I just give you my whole self, my future, my resources. All that I am is yours. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing, because then God is like, okay, I'll take that and I'll begin to shape you and mold you. I'll call to you. I'll lead you. I'll strengthen you. I'll bring you to that place, into that work that is the work of eternity, is the work of the kingdom, and you will have a role to play. You'll make a difference and it will change your life. That's where it begins, right there. It's really pretty sweet. What Mary teaches us in the worthiness of Jesus is that in presenting all that she has, it's pretty sweet and energizing. Just the aroma of gratitude. She is weeping tears of joy and thankfulness to Jesus for who he is, for what he's about. And the power of gratitude is so profound, isn't it? A person who's really at a place where they've given up expectations, why isn't God doing this in my life? Why isn't God doing the other thing or whatever? And it's taken that belief posture that says that God is gracious and everything that I have is a gift from him. He gave you your intelligence, your personality, your moment in time, people in your life. These things are not accidental, that God has moved this way for you because he loves you, because he wants to show you his kindness and his mercy. He wants to show you his wisdom and his leadership in your life. He cares for you. And when we're at a place where we are seeing that, we're recognizing that, and are just able to turn our hearts to him in gratitude and say, thank you. And to live in that context, and just to be able to say, I'm so thankful, and to be able to be specific. I thank you for my wife. She has labored with me for 31 years. I don't know anyone on this earth that could labor with me for 31 years. I thank you for the long friendships that I have been able to develop, not because I'm a very interesting friend, but because you're so merciful to me. You bring people into my life that really just kind of connect with needs that I have, and I'm somehow able to meet theirs, and there's a brotherhood, and I thank you so much for that. And just to be able to live in a place of gratitude is just, it's pleasant. And the converse is also true, that when we live in unfulfilled expectations of love demands of this kind of thing, it stinks. You know, it's just like, ugh, who did that? You know? Raw eggs. Rotten eggs, I guess it is. That's what it's like when we lose gratitude. It stinks. How do people smell you? See, so Mary teaches us the worthiness of Christ. She demonstrates that, and then she does a second thing. She shows us that belief involves risk. Yeah, absolutely, there is risk. Mary is convinced about what's at stake. That is an important part of the life of faith. There's risk, but it's risk that we take because of the things of which we are convinced, we're confident of. Convinced that what's at stake, for instance, is that her legacy of faith trumps the empty pursuits of worldly security. She casts her worldly security onto Christ because she knows that in granting him total access to her life, that's way more secure, that's a way better foundation than the price of nard. And so here's the thing, that faith is not just something that you intellectually accept and then motor on with your life. Belief involves a wager, it's a risk, and we are wagering our lives on ventures of radical faith versus holding our cards close to the vest in fear and anxiety. Your faith will grow to the extent that you're willing to invest it, to put it out on the table, to say yes to God. What is the Christ people see when they observe your faith? That would be an important question to ask. And, you know, what people see when they look at Mary's faith is a God that is so welcoming, that all social stigma is broken, that a woman is welcome in his presence, that he has given his life to her family, to her good. And she just responds in grace and in gratitude for that. And people sense that. Some people are repelled by that because they don't want to be given a gift, even if it's from God. But what do people see when they observe your faith? What are those acts of faith that demonstrate what you really are about? At the end of the day, the rubber's got to hit the road someplace. It's got to come outside your head and into the way that you live. So how we handle our role as parents, how we handle our financial resources, what we do with our time, all of these things are displaying something. They're saying, this is who I think Christ is. Mary's example of faith shows us what's at stake, that what's worth a lot costs a lot. What's worth a lot costs a lot. I mean a couple things by that. In Matthew 26, verse 12, Jesus makes the point, he says, that when she did this, she poured this perfume on my body. She did it to prepare me for burial. And in a certain way, that what she did was because he had risen from the dead, on the third day, there was no opportunity to anoint his body with the perfumes, with the nards and stuff like that. What she did, no one else was able to do. It's kind of interesting how that works out. She uniquely is able to serve Jesus in that way. And what she does points to, Jesus says in a very public context, his own burial. That's pretty interesting. What does his death mean? It means that you are a precious treasure to God. That's what it means. When Jesus was describing the heart of God in Luke 15, he gives three examples. He says that God loves and pursues things that are valuable to him and which are lost. The lost coin, the lost sheep, leaving the 99, going after that one, and the lost son, the prodigal son. So we have this picture of the heart of God not folding his hands in his eternal discontent with your miserable existence, but with the outstretched arms of a father waiting for his son to return to him so that he could demonstrate his great love. You are a precious value to God, and because you are a precious value to God, God has purchased your forgiveness at the cost of Christ. That's what she did. She anointed his body for burial. That burial marked the end of the conflict between you and God, because in the cross he took upon himself the death that you deserve, the weight of all your guilt, and he took it out of the way. And so when Mary anoints his body like this, she takes something of great value. Yes, that's right. But what's worth a lot costs a lot. The love of God was not cheap. It was expensive for him. He gave all that he could so that he could grant you a gift. And so to really, in an enduring way, in this life, to be able to benefit from the great gift that God has given to you, he calls you to give yourself to him. Mary's example of faith shows that life is no game, and that everyone goes all in on something. What are you pouring your life out for? Well, you say, I'm pouring it a little here, and a little here, and a little here, and a little here, and a little here. And I'm saying, what do all those things have in common? the heart, the arm of that radius comes right back to self. You're pouring out your life on you. Right? And that's a failed way of living, my friends. That's the way that the world lives. The world is asking, what can I get from this world? And Jesus Christ came to this world to give and says to his followers, pour yourself out on me. Go in, all in with me. And I will send you out to the world, not to possess, to complete you, to whatever, but to be a servant and to be my agent of eternal transformation in this world. That's what it's all about. What are you all in for? You know, if you allow yourself to ask that question, it raises the most penetrating and important question that you could ask. What are you all in for? Man, I think Mary today is saying, yeah, about that nard thing. That was really impulsive of me. I really want that nard back. Of course not. She's like, oh, I had an opportunity to create a legacy of faith that speaks 2,000 years later. And so do you.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.